Hugh Buckley, I'd love to begin just about Yale, because there's this unbelievable blossoming of Yale public men from the 60s, basically, in this race, including Joe Lieberman and Howard Dean, as well as John Kerry and George Bush. How's to explain that to the world?
I don't think there's any explanation for it beyond the fact that Yale encourages applications and receives them from back then only young men who were full of life.
So does Stanford and Harvard.
People who are, you know, who are full of life tend to look for means of expressing themselves. In any case, what is it about New Haven that generates anything special? Answer, I don't know.
Let me just say, from my own experience in the early 60s, I was very well aware of two bills, Buckley and Bill Coffin, who was then the minister. Both of you roughly contemporary in the late 40s, early 50s at Yale. You were a figure of the right even then, he of the left. Between the two of you, there was a tremendous charge to get out there and do something. And I don't know that most other campuses felt that.
I would have to think. One associates most of the animation and over-high animation of the 60s with California, with Stanford, and how any competitive ranking based on ergs of idealism would come off matching, say, Stanford and Yale and Harvard, I simply don't know. If I thought I could give you a personal distillation of whatever it is that gets imbibed by people who spend time in New Haven, I would do so.
Hmm.
So I'm not holding anything back. I'm just confessing that I'm not good at the kind of sociology that attracts some people productively, and you're one of them.
What do you make of the Bill Coffin influence? As I look back, I must say, Bill Coffin's example there at Battelle Chapel, and I was not a communicant, but he was deeply involved in civil rights, in liberalism, later against the war in Vietnam. I say he was hugely influential, even on people who didn't necessarily follow him.
Well, the answer is he was. For one thing, he was a radiant human being, a man of enormous attractiveness, an eloquent orator, a good phrase maker, and he has a pretty good sense of humor. In my own judgment, and this will not surprise you or him, he didn't, at the end of the line, draw necessary distinctions, and in so doing, confused a lot of people. I once, I forget, it was just about 25 years ago when people were talking about burning their draft cards.
Yes.
There was some question whether Bill actually said burn your draft card or whether he didn't. And then there was ambiguity about a couple of people who were actually defendants in some proceeding on the question of whether they had, you know, violated the law, which you do violate if you ask people to burn up government documents. And I said to him, look, if you want to establish that this is what you are doing without ambiguity, I'll invite you to do it on my television program.
Hmm.
And that went out jointly to the famous baby doctor who was involved in that kind of activity. And he pulled away. What I'm saying is that that his passion, in my judgment, sometimes overruled not only good sense but a good sense of obligation.
Hmm.
His obligation was as chaplain of Yale, and though a lot of people will say that his spirit enormously animated them. And then cause them to be more idealistic than they otherwise would have pretended to be. I think it's also true that some people were derailed from a curiosity about Christianity, in part because they thought that serve as an adequate Christian, one had to take positions like Bill Coffin's, which was not true. So this, he and I have argued about this over the years, and he put it this way: he is certainly getting his due in the sense that he's widely celebrated, and he's an old venerable veteran of those particular wars.
In the grand typology of Yale types, I just wonder, can you place John Kerry and George W. Bush? In my memory of that campus, the funny part of it is, although George Bush is one of yours now, John Kerry was much closer to the William F. Buckley type as a tall debater, pillar of the political union, and a man unmistakably bound for public life, as George Bush was unmistakably bound for the country club, it would have seemed.
Oh, well, I think you're quite correct, and I don't think Bush would begin to disagree with you. George W. Bush at Yale was primarily a passerby. Now, we like to think, and I think there's reason to suppose, that notwithstanding his relative nonchalance, he picked up certain attitudes from Yale, as he had from his father and from his grandfather, that tilted him in the direction of a public life. But not to be compared with John Kerry. John Kerry, from day one, was called what you were, idealist on the make or ideologue on the make. In any event, he was hugely involved at Yale, as I understand it, in a life that takes public exposure and public issues as of an intense interest. And George Bush was not.
We used to say of the George Bush types, hadn't had his first serious thought yet. The Kerry type could be overbearing, but he filled that, I'd have to say he filled that role pretty impressively over the years.
If we talk about serious thoughts, one has to be cautious. There's no question that John Kerry's turn against the Vietnam War was a, quote, serious thought.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very deep spade that he dug into the ground to make his points about the war. Now, if he had that kind of serious thought when he was an undergraduate, I don't know of it, and nor do I know what it was that he stressed. In the matter of George Bush, I think there was a kind of inherited patrimony, a kind of a vague orientation, which I think would have been true of Virginia gentlemen 200 years ago. They just assumed that one of these days they would participate in political life and may very well end up spending most of their time on it.
Hmm.
But I don't think it was vocational, even with Kerry, and it certainly wasn't with me, I don't think. Until I wrote a book and got sort of involved directly in issues of public concern.
God and Man at Yale, I remember it well. I can't tell you how many times I read it. Probably threw it at the wall a number of times too. It was something to chew on, and we had to do it. I want to ask you another question, Bill, about the angle that George Bush says is too secret to talk about. I keep thinking, surely if we were talking about an election in China, a world-shaking confrontation of opposing forces in a great nation, we would be talking about the fact that both of the champions had been blood brothers in a secret undergraduate network that encompasses Wall Street and the world and God knows how many powerful names, including your own. I won't mention the society because you'd have to leave the room or hang up on me, but
But the curiosity, the kind of curiosity that you're speaking about, would certainly inquire into your membership, let's say, in a Leninist cell.
Yes.
In the late teens, or a Trotskyist cell, or if you like, even a Randite cell.
Yes.
But I don't think the kind of curiosity that is incited by philosophical and political questions would attach simply to any society, simply in virtue of its being secret.
Well, what do you think the implications of all that are? I mean, to me, the secrecy is important. Elitism, almost to the point of parody, but also this matter of entitlement, which is not exactly vocation, but just you will be an important public man, given to young guys at an early age, and it will encompass the world.
Chris, you sly old thing, you're trying to get me to comment on your description, imputed description, to the society that I'm not discussing. we don't really know what is. I'm trying to think of. I'm trying to think of an analogy. There aren't many. But the idea that a young man is enrolled and invested in a life purpose, whether to serve God or to destroy capitalism, that doesn't attach normally to any organization simply because it's closed. It's a fallacy which in my better days I could have given you the formal name of, to assume that because it's secret, it is therefore interesting for the same reasons that it is interesting in certain other secret societies.
No, it's interesting because it's powerful, or at least it seems to be.
Was that a question?
Yeah, well, in the form of a statement, I guess, yeah.
And repeat it, if you don't mind.
Well, it's interesting not just because it's secret. You know, every kid has had a little secret club in the neighborhood.
Exactly.
At age 8. But they don't rule the world. They don't encompass, you know, McGeorge Bundy and Avril Harriman and a great deal of the CIA and you and Bill Coffin and a lot of good folk out there. I mean, it does look like something more than a little kid's club.
Well, it's fun to play with those things. I'm trying to remember the name of the... Elliot Richardson, who said that anybody who has served as a chief editor of the Harvard Law Review...
Yes.
...belongs to the single most distinguished fraternity in American civilization.
Now including Barack Obama.
Was he editor?
He was. He was the first African-American editor.
Is that right?
Yeah.
My goodness. I knew he was at... in the Law Review, but I didn't know that he was actually the editor. Is that always meritocratic, that election?
I believe it is. With the usual...
preferences.
Yeah, and funny history. I remember Charles Wyszanski, a federal judge, saying...
Yeah, I remember him.
Who observed Elliot Richardson and Bill Bundy together on the Harvard Law Review, saying they were the last of those upper-class WASs who felt they had to run the race against the Jews and win.
There you are.
And he said it with affection for Jews and for Bundy and Richardson.
In any case, a member of the Harvard Law Review was a highly accomplished and singular person. And I suppose if one said, well, look around and find people who were editors of the Harvard Law Review, and there is the skin of... of effective politics, one could play games like that. And of course, there's only one Law Review, but the organization we're talking about has 15 members, so it's easier to do.